my hair. I think it was just a neighbor, I said, watching the car's rear lights as it made its way farther up the canyon. Harry grabbed my hand. We could do it, you know. What? We could get married. I mean, as long as we're going to pretend to do it, we could really do it. It's not so crazy. After all, I love you. Maybe not the way a husband is supposed to love a wife, but enough, I think. Harry. And what I told you yesterday about wanting a wife, I've been thinking, and if this works, if people buy it, maybe we could raise a family together. Don't you want to have a family? Yes, I said, eventually I think I do. We could be great for each other. And we won't just give up when the bloom falls off the rose because we already know each other better than that. Harry, I can't tell if you're serious. I'm dead serious. At least I think I am. You want to marry me. I want to be with someone I love. I want to have a companion. I'd like to bring someone home to my family. I don't want to live alone anymore. And I want a son or a daughter. We could have that together. I can't give you everything, I know that, but I want to raise a family, and I'd love to raise one with you. Harry, I'm cynical, and I'm bossy, and most people would consider me vaguely immoral. You're strong and resilient and talented. You're exceptional, inside and out. He had really thought about this. And you and your proclivities, how does that work? The same as it has with you and Rex. I do what I do, discreetly, of course. You do what you do. But I don't want to continue to have affairs my entire life. I want to be with someone I'm in love with, someone who's in love with me. Well, that I can't help you with, Harry said. For that one, you have to call her. I looked down at my lap, stared at my fingernails. Would she take me back? She and John, me and Harry. It could actually work. It could work so beautifully. And if I couldn't have her, did I want anyone else? I was pretty sure that if I couldn't have her, all I wanted was a life with Harry. Okay, I said. Let's do it. Another car came up behind us, and Harry grabbed me again. This time he kissed me slowly, passionately. When a guy jumped out of his car with a camera, Harry pretended, just for a split second, that he didn't see him, and slipped his hand down the top of my dress. The image printed in the papers the next week was tawdry, scandalous, and shocking. It showed us with swollen faces and looks of guilt, Harry's hand clearly on my breast. The next day, everyone was printing headlines that Joy Nathan was pregnant. The four of us were the talk of the nation. Unscrupulous, unfaithful, lustful sinners. Carolina Sunset set a record for the longest stay in theaters. And to celebrate our divorce, Rex and I shared a pair of dirty martinis. To our successful union, Rex said, and then we clinked our glasses and drank.
It is 3 in the morning by the time I get home. Evelyn had downed 4 cups of coffee and apparently felt wired enough to keep talking. I could have bowed out at any point, but on some level, I think I welcomed the excuse not to go back to my own life for a little while. Being wrapped up in digesting Evelyn's story means I don't have to exist in my own. And anyway, it's not my place to go making the rules. I picked my battle. I won. The rest is up to her. So when I get home, I crawl into bed and will myself to fall asleep quickly. My last thought as I go to sleep is that I am relieved I have a valid excuse for why I haven't responded to David's text yet. I'm woken up by my cell phone ringing, and I look at the time. It's almost 9. It's Saturday. I was hoping to sleep in. My phone shows my mother's face smiling at me. It's not quite 6, her time. Mom? Is everything okay? Of course it is, she says, as if she's calling at noon. I just wanted to try and catch you and say hi before you headed out for the day. It's not even 6 a.m. where you are, I say. And it's the weekend. I'm mostly planning on sleeping in and transcribing some of the hours of Evelyn's recordings. We had a small earthquake about a half hour ago. Now I can't go back to sleep. How's it going with Evelyn? I feel weird calling her Evelyn, like I know her or something. I tell her about getting Frankie to agree to a promotion. I tell her that I got Evelyn to agree to a cover story. You're telling me you went up against the editor-in-chief of Vivant and Evelyn Hugo both within 24 hours, and you came out getting what you want from everyone? I laugh, surprised at how impressive it sounds. Yeah, I say. I guess I did. My mom lets out what can only be described as a cackle. That's my girl, she says. Oof, let me tell you, your father would be beaming right now if he were here. Would just be glowing with pride. He always knew you were going to be a force to be reckoned with. I wonder if this is true. Not because my mom has ever really lied to me, but because it's just so hard for me to imagine. I can see my dad thinking I'd grow up to be kind or smart, that makes sense. But I've never thought of myself as a force to be reckoned with. Maybe I should start thinking of myself that way. Maybe I deserve to. I kind of am, aren't I? Don't mess with me, world. I'm out to get mine. That's right, honey, that you are. As I tell my mom I love her and I hang up the phone, I feel proud of myself, smug even. I have no idea that in less than a week, Evelyn Hugo will finish her story, and I'll find out what this has all been about. And I will hate her so much that I'll be truly afraid I might kill her.
Brilliant, kind-hearted, tortured Harry Cameron. I was nominated for Best Actress for Carolina Sunset. The only problem was that Celia was nominated that year, too. I showed up on the red carpet with Harry. We were engaged. He'd given me a diamond and emerald ring. It stood out against the black beaded dress I wore that night. Two slits on either side of the skirt went up to my mid-thigh. I loved that dress. And so did everyone else. I've noticed that when people do retrospectives of my career, photos of me in that dress always make it in somehow. I made sure it would be included in the auction. I think it could raise a lot of money. It makes me happy that people love that dress as much as I do. I lost an Oscar, but it ended up being one of the greatest nights of my life. Celia arrived just before the show began. She was wearing a pale blue strapless gown with a sweetheart neckline. The color of her hair against the dress was striking. When my eyes set on her for the first time in nearly 5 years, I found myself breathless. I'd gone to see every single one of Celia's movies, even though I was loath to admit it, so I had seen her. But no medium can capture what it is to be in someone's presence. Certainly not someone like her. Someone who makes you feel important simply because she's choosing to look at you. There was something stately about her at the age of 28. She was mature and dignified. She looked like the kind of person who knew exactly who she was. She stepped forward and took John Braverman's arm. In a tux that seemed to strain at his broad shoulders, John looked as all-American as a husk of corn. They were a gorgeous couple, no matter how false it all was. "Ev, you're staring," Harry said as he pushed me into the theater. "Sorry," I said, "thank you." As we took our seats, we smiled and waved to everyone seated around us. Joy and Rex were a few rows behind us, and I waved politely, knowing people were watching, knowing that if I ran up and hugged them, people might be confused. When we sat down, Harry said, "If you win, will you talk to her?" I laughed. "And gloat?" No, but you'd have the upper hand that you seem to so desperately want. She left me. You slept with someone. For her. Harry frowned at me as if I was missing the point. Fine, if I win, I'll talk to her. Thank you. Why are you thanking me? Because I want you to be happy, and it appears I have to reward you for doing things in your own favor. Well, if she wins, I'm not saying a single word to her. If she wins, Harry said delicately, which is a big if, and she comes and talks to you, I will hold you down and force you to listen and speak back. I couldn't look directly at him. I was feeling defensive. It's a moot point anyway, I said. Everyone knows they're going to give it to Ruby because they feel bad she didn't get it last year for the dangerous flight. They might not, Harry said. Yeah, yeah, I told him, and I've got a bridge in Brooklyn to sell you. But when the lights dimmed and the host came out, I was not thinking that my chances were slim. I was just delusional enough to think the Academy might finally give me a goddamn Oscar. When they called out the nominees for Best Actress, I scanned the audience for Celia. I spotted her the very same moment she spotted me. We locked eyes, and then the presenter didn't say Evelyn or Celia. He said Ruby. When my heart sank into my chest, aching and heavy, I was mad at myself for believing I had a chance. And then I wondered if Celia was okay. Harry held my hand and squeezed it. I hoped John was squeezing Celia's. I excused myself to the bathroom. Bonnie Lakeland was washing her hands as I came in. She gave me a smile, and then she left. And I was alone. I sat in a stall and closed the door. I let myself cry. Evelyn? You don't spend years pining away for one voice, not to notice it when it finally appears. Celia, I said. My back was to the stall door. I wiped my eyes. I saw you come in here, she said. I thought it might be a sign that you weren't, that you were upset. I'm trying to be happy for Ruby, I said, laughing just a little bit as I used a piece of toilet paper to carefully dry my eyes. But it's not exactly my style. Mine either, she said. I opened the door, and there she was, blue dress, red hair, small stature, with a presence that filled the whole room. And when her eyes set on me, I knew she still loved me. I could see it in the way her pupils widened and softened. You're as gorgeous as ever, she said, as she leaned against the sink, her arms holding her weight behind her. There was always something intoxicating about the way Celia looked at me. I felt like a rare steak in front of a tiger. You're not so bad yourself, I said. We probably shouldn't be caught in here together, Celia said. Why not? I asked. Because I suspect more than a few people seated in there know what we once got up to, she said. I know you'd hate for them to think we were up to it again. This was a test. I knew it, she knew it. If I said the right thing, if I told her I didn't care what they thought, if I told her I'd make love to her in the middle of the stage in front of all of them, I just might be able to have her back. I let myself think about it for a moment. I let myself think about waking up tomorrow to her cigarette and coffee breath. But I wanted her to admit it wasn't all me, that she had played a part in our demise. Or maybe you just don't want to be seen with a, what was the word you used? I believe it was whore. Celia laughed and looked down at the floor and then back up at me. What do you want me to say? That I was wrong? I was. I wanted to hurt you like you hurt me. But I never meant to hurt you, I said. Never once would I have done a single thing to hurt you on purpose. You were ashamed to love me. Absolutely not, I said. That is absolutely untrue. Well, you certainly went to great lengths to hide it. I did what had to be done to protect both of us.
Debatable.
So debate it with me, I said, instead of running away again. I didn't run far, Evelyn. You could have caught up with me if you wanted to. I don't like being played, Celia. I told you that the first time we went out for milkshakes. She shrugged. You play everyone else. I have never claimed that I wasn't a hypocrite.
How do you do that? Celia said.
Do what?
Act so cavalier about things that are sacred to other people.
Because other people have got nothing to do with me.
Celia scoffed, somewhat gently, and looked down at her hands.
Except you, I said.
I was rewarded with the sight of her looking up at me.
I care about you, I said.
You cared about me.
I shook my head. No, I didn't misspeak.
You certainly moved on fast enough with Rex North.
I frowned at her. Celia, you know better than that.
So it was fake.
Every moment.
Have you been with anyone else? Any men? She asked. She was always jealous of the men, worried she couldn't compete. I was jealous of the women, worried I wouldn't compare.
I've had a good time, I said, as I'm sure you've had.
John isn't...
I'm not talking about John, but I'm sure you haven't kept chaste. I was fishing for information that might break my heart, a flaw of the human condition.
No, she said, you're right about that.
Men? I asked, hoping the answer was yes. If it was men, I knew it didn't mean anything to her. She shook her head, and my heart broke just a little bit more, like a tear that deepens from strain.
Anyone I know?
None of them were famous, she said. None of them meant anything to me. I touched them and thought of what it felt like to touch you.
My heart both ached and swelled to hear it.
You shouldn't have left me, Celia.
You shouldn't have let me leave.
And with that, I had no more fight in me. My heart cried out the truth through my throat.
I know. I know that. I know.
Sometimes things happen so quickly, you aren't sure when you even realize they were about to begin. One minute she was leaning against the sink, the next her hands were on my face, her body pressed against me, her lips between mine. She tasted like the musky creaminess of thick lipstick and the sharp, spiced sting of rum. I was lost in her, in the feel of her on me once again, the sheer joy of her attention, the glory of knowing she loved me. And then the door was flung open, and the wives of two producers walked in. We broke apart. Celia pretended she had been washing her hands, and I moved to one of the mirrors and fixed my makeup. The two women talked together, caught up in their conversation, barely noticing us. They entered two stalls, and I looked at Celia. She looked at me. I watched her turn off the faucet and take a towel. I worried that she might walk right out the bathroom door. But she didn't. One of the wives left, and then the other. We were finally alone again. Listening closely, we could tell the show had come back from a commercial break. I grabbed Celia and kissed her. I pushed her up against the door. I couldn't get enough of her. I needed her. She was as much of a fix to me as any drug. Before I even stopped to consider the danger, I lifted her dress and slipped my hand up her thigh. I held her against the door, I kissed her, and with one hand I touched her the way I knew she liked. She moaned slightly and put her hand over her mouth. I kissed her neck, and the two of us, our bodies tightly wound, shuddered against the door. We could have been caught at any moment. If one woman in the whole auditorium chose to visit the ladies' room during those 7 minutes, we'd have lost everything we'd worked so hard for. That is how Celia and I forgave each other, and how we knew we couldn't live without each other. Because now, We both knew what we were willing to risk, just to be together.
Photo moment. August 14, 1967. Evelyn Hugo weds producer Harry Cameron. Fifth time's a charm? Evelyn Hugo and producer Harry Cameron married last Saturday during a ceremony on the beaches of Capri. Evelyn wore an off-white silk gown and had her long blonde hair down and parted in the middle. Harry, known for being one of the better-dressed Hollywood players, wore a cream-colored linen suit. Celia St. James, America's sweetheart, attended as the maid of honor, and her fabulous hubby, John Braverman, served as the best man. Harry and Evelyn have been working together since the 50s, when Evelyn came to fame in such hits as Father and Daughter and Little Women. They admitted they were having an affair late last year when they were caught in flagrante while Evelyn was still married to Rex North. Rex is now married to Joy Nathan and the proud papa of their little girl, Violet North. We're glad that Evelyn and Harry have decided to finally make it official. After such a shocking beginning to their relationship and a long engagement, all we can say is, it's about time.
Celia got absolutely smashed during the wedding. She was having a hard time not being jealous, even though she knew the whole thing was fake. Her own husband was standing next to Harry, for crying out loud. And we all knew what we were. Two men sleeping together. Married to two women sleeping together. We were four beards. And what I thought as I said, I do, was, it's all beginning now. Real life. Our life. We're finally going to be a family. Harry and John were in love. Celia and I were sky high. When we got back from Italy, I sold my mansion in Beverly Hills. Harry sold his. We bought this place in Manhattan on the Upper East Side, just down the street from Celia and John. Before I agreed to move, I had Harry look into whether my father was still alive. I wasn't sure I could live in the same city he lived in, wasn't sure I could handle the idea of running into him. But when Harry's assistant searched for him, I learned that my father had died in 1959 of a heart attack. What little he owned was absorbed by the state when no one came forward to claim it. My first thought when I heard he was gone was, so that's why he never tried to come after me for money. And my second was, how sad that I'm certain that's all he'd ever want. I put it out of my head, signed the paperwork on the apartment, and celebrated the purchase with Harry. I was free to go wherever I wanted. And what I wanted was to move to the Upper East Side of Manhattan. I persuaded Luisa to join us. This apartment might be within a long walk's distance, but I was a million miles away from Hell's Kitchen. And I was world famous, married, in love, and so rich it sometimes made me sick. A month after we moved to town, Celia and I took a taxi to Hell's Kitchen and walked around the neighborhood. It looked so different from when I left. I brought her to the sidewalk just below my old building and pointed at the window that used to be mine. "Right there," I said. On the fifth floor. Celia looked at me with compassion for all I had been through when I lived there, for all I had done for myself since then. And then she calmly, confidently took my hand. I bristled, unsure if we should be touching in public, scared of what people would do. But the rest of the people on the street just kept on walking, kept on living their lives, almost entirely unaware of or uninterested in the two famous women holding hands on the sidewalk. Celia and I spent our nights together in this apartment. Harry spent his nights with John at their place. We went out to dinner in public, the four of us looking like two pairs of heterosexuals, without a heterosexual in the bunch. The tabloids called us America's favorite double daters. I even heard rumors that the four of us were swingers, which wasn't that crazy for that period of time. It really makes you think, doesn't it, that people were so eager to believe we were swapping spouses, but would have been scandalized to know we were monogamous and queer. I'll never forget the morning after the Stonewall riots. Harry was at rapt attention, watching the news. John was on the phone all day with friends of his who lived downtown. Celia was pacing the living room floor, her heart racing. She believed everything was going to change after that night. She believed that because gay people had announced themselves, had been proud enough to admit who they were, and strong enough to stand up, attitudes were going to change. I remember sitting out on our rooftop patio looking southward and realizing that Celia, Harry, John, and I weren't alone. It seems silly to say now, but I was so self-involved, so singularly focused, that I rarely took time to think of the people out there like myself. That isn't to say that I wasn't aware of the way the country was changing. Harry and I campaigned for Bobby Kennedy. Celia posed with Vietnam protesters on the cover of Effect. John was a vocal supporter of the civil rights movement, and I had been a very public supporter of the work of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. But this was different. This was our people. And here they were, revolting against the police in the name of their right to be themselves, while I was sitting in a golden prison of my own making. I was out on the terrace, directly in the sun, on the afternoon after the initial riots, wearing high-waisted jeans and a black sleeveless top, drinking a Gibson, and I started crying when I realized those men were willing to fight for a dream I had never even allowed myself to envision. A world where we could be ourselves, without fear and without shame. Those men were braver and more hopeful than I was. There were simply no other words for it. "There's a plan to riot again tonight," John said as he joined me on the patio. He had such an intimidating physical presence, more than 6 feet tall, 225 pounds, with a tight crew cut. He looked like a guy you didn't want to mess with. But anyone who knew him, and especially those of us who loved him, knew he was the first guy you could mess with. He may have been a warrior on the football field, but he was the sweetheart of our foursome. He was the guy who asked how you slept the night before, the guy who always remembered the smallest thing you said 3 weeks ago. And he took it on as his job to protect Celia and Harry, and by extension, me. John and I loved the same people, and so we loved each other. And we also loved playing gin rummy. I can't tell you how many nights I stayed up late finishing a hand of cards with John. The two of us deadly competitive, trading off who was the gloating winner and who was the sore loser. "We should go down there," Celia said, joining us. John took a seat in a chair in the corner. Celia sat on the arm of the chair I was in. "We should support them. We should be a part of this." I could hear Harry calling John's name from the kitchen. "We're out here," I yelled to him at the same moment as John said, "I'm on the patio." Soon Harry appeared in the doorway. "Harry, don't you think we should go down there?" Celia said. She lit a cigarette, took a drag, and handed it to me. I was already shaking my head. John outright told her no.
"What do you mean, no?" Celia said.
"You're not going down there," John said. "You can't. None of us can."
"Of course I can," she said, looking to me to back her up.
"Sorry," I said, giving her the cigarette back. "I'm with John on this."
"Harry?" she said, hoping to make one final successful plea.
Harry shook his head. "We go down there. All we do is attract attention away from the cause and toward us. The story becomes about whether we're homosexuals, and not about the rights of homosexuals. Celia put the cigarette to her lips and inhaled. She had a sour look on her face as she blew the smoke into the air.
So what do we do then? We can't sit here and do nothing. We can't let them fight our fight for us.
We give them what we have and they don't, Harry said. Money, I said, following his train of thought. John nodded. I'll call Peter. He'll know how we can fund them. He'll know who needs resources.
We should have been doing that all along, Harry said. So let's just do it from now on, no matter what happens tonight, no matter what course this fight takes. Let's just decide here and now that our job is to fund.
I'm in, I said.
Yeah, John nodded, of course.
Okay, Celia said, if you're sure that's the way we can do the most good.
It is, Harry said. I'm sure of it.
We started filtering money privately that day, and I've continued to do so the rest of my life. In the pursuit of a great cause, I think people can be of service in a number of different ways. I always felt that my way was to make a lot of money and then channel it to the groups that needed it. It's a bit self-serving, that logic, I know that. But because of who I was, because of the sacrifices I made to hide parts of myself, I was able to give more money than most people ever see in their entire lifetime. I am proud of that. But it does not mean I wasn't conflicted. And of course, a lot of the time, that ambivalence was even more personal than it was political. I knew it was imperative that I hide, and yet I did not believe I should have to. But accepting that something is true isn't the same as thinking that it is just. Celia won her second Oscar in 1970 for her role as a woman who cross-dresses to serve as a World War I soldier in the film Our Men. I could not be in Los Angeles with her that night because I was shooting Jade Diamond in Miami. I was playing a prostitute living in the same apartment as a drunk. But Celia and I both knew that even if I had been free as a bird, I could not go to the Academy Awards on her arm. That evening, Celia called me after she was home from the ceremony and all the parties. I screamed into the phone. I was so happy for her. "You've done it," I said. "Twice now, you've done it."
"Can you believe it?" she said. "Two of them."
"You deserve them. The whole world should be giving you an Oscar every day as far as I'm concerned."
"I wish you were here," she said petulantly. I could tell she'd been drinking. I would have been drinking too if I'd been in her position. But I was irritated that she had to make things so difficult. I wanted to be there. Didn't she know that? Didn't she know that I couldn't be there? And that it killed me? Why did it always have to be about what all of this felt like for her?
"I wish I was too," I told her. "But it's better this way, you know that."
"Ah, yes, so that people won't know you're a lesbian."
I hated being called a lesbian. Not because I thought there was anything wrong with loving a woman, mind you. No, I'd come to terms with that a long time ago. But Celia only saw things in black and white. She liked women. And only women. And I liked her. And so she often denied the rest of me. She liked to ignore the fact that I had truly loved Don Adler once. She liked to ignore the fact that I had made love to men and enjoyed it. She liked to ignore it until the very moment she decided to be threatened by it. That seemed to be her pattern. I was a lesbian when she loved me, and a straight woman when she hated me. People were just starting to talk about the idea of bisexuality, but I'm not sure I even understood that the word referred to me then. I wasn't interested in finding a label for what I already knew. I loved men. I loved Celia. I was okay with that.
"Celia, stop it. I'm sick of this conversation. You're being a brat."
She laughed coldly. "Exactly the same, Evelyn, I've been dealing with for years. Nothing's changed. You're afraid of who you are, and you still don't have an Oscar. You are what you have always been, a nice pair of tits. I let the silence hang in the air for a moment. The buzz of the phone was the only sound either of us could hear. And then Celia started crying. "I'm so sorry," she said. "I should never have said that. I don't even mean it. I'm so sorry. I've had too much to drink, and I miss you, and I'm sorry that I said something so terrible." "It's fine," I said. "I should be going. It's late here, you understand. Congratulations again, sweetheart." I hung up before she could reply. That was how it was with Celia. When you denied her what she wanted, when you hurt her, she made sure you hurt too.
"Did you ever call her on it?" I ask Evelyn. I hear the muffled sound of my phone ringing in my bag, and I know from the ringtone that it's David. I did not return his text over the weekend because I wasn't sure what I wanted to say. And then, once I got here again this morning, I put it out of my mind. I reach over and turn the ringer off. "There was no point in fighting with Celia once she got mean," Evelyn says. "If things got too tense, I tended to back off before they came to a head. I would tell her I loved her, and I couldn't live without her. And then I'd take my top off, and that usually ended the conversation." For all her posturing, Celia had one thing in common with almost every straight man in America. She wanted nothing more than to get her hands on my chest. "Did it stick with you, though?" I ask. "Those words?" "Of course it did. Look, I'd be the first person to say back when I was young that all I was a nice pair of tits. The only currency I had was my sexuality, and I used it like money. I wasn't well educated when I got to Hollywood. I wasn't book smart, I wasn't powerful, I wasn't a trained actress. What did I have to be good at other than being beautiful? And taking pride in your beauty is a damning act, because you allow yourself to believe that the only thing notable about yourself is something with a very short shelf life." She goes on. "When Celia said that to me, I had crossed into my 30s. I wasn't sure I had many more good years left, to be honest. I thought, you know, sure, Celia would keep getting work because people were hiring her for her talent. I wasn't so sure they would continue hiring me once the wrinkles set in, once my metabolism slowed down. So yeah, it hurt a lot." "But you had to know you were talented," I tell her. "You had been nominated for an Academy Award 3 times by that point." "You're using reason," Evelyn says, smiling at me. "It doesn't always work."
In 1974, on my 36th birthday, Harry, Celia, John, and I all went out to the Palace. It was supposedly the most expensive restaurant in the world during that time, and I was the sort of person who liked being extravagant and absurd. I look back on it now, and I wonder where I got off throwing money around so casually, as if the fact that it came easily to me meant I had no responsibility to value it. I find it mildly mortifying now. The caviar, the private planes, the staff big enough to populate a baseball team. But the palace it was. We posed for pictures, knowing they would end up in some tabloid or another. Celia bought us a bottle of Dom Perignon. Harry put back 4 Manhattans himself. And when the dessert came with a lit candle in the middle, the 3 of them sang for me as people looked on. Harry was the only one who had a piece of the cake. Celia and I were watching our figures, and John was on a strict regimen that had him mostly eating protein. "At least have a bite, Ev," John said good-naturedly as he took the plate away from Harry and pushed it toward me. "It's your birthday, for crying out loud." I raised an eyebrow and grabbed a fork, using it to scrape a forkful of the chocolate fudge icing. When you're right, I said to him. He just doesn't think I should have it, Harry said. John laughed. Two birds with one stone. Celia lightly tapped her fork against her glass. Okay, okay, she said. Small speech time. She was due to shoot a film in Montana the following week. She'd postponed the start date so she could be with me that night. To Evelyn, she said, lifting her glass in the air, who has lit up every goddamn room she ever walked into, and who, day after day, makes us feel like we're living in a dream. Later that night, as Celia and John went out to hail a cab, Harry gently helped me put my jacket on. Do you realize that I'm the longest marriage you've had? He asked. By that point, Harry and I had been married for almost 7 years. And also the best, I said, bar none. I was thinking. I already knew what he was thinking, or at least I suspected what he was thinking because I'd been thinking it too. I was 36. If we were going to have a baby, I'd put it off for as long as I could. Sure, there were women having babies later than that, but it wasn't very common, and I had spent the last few years staring at babies in strollers, unable to focus my eyes on anything else when they were around. I would pick up friends' babies and hold them tightly until the very moment their mothers demanded them back. I thought of what my own child might be like. I thought of how it would feel to bring a life into the world, to give the four of us another being to focus on. But if I was going to do it, I had to get moving. And our decision to have a baby wasn't really just a two-person conversation. It was a four-person conversation. Go on, I said, as we made our way to the front of the restaurant. Say it. A baby, Harry said. You and me. Have you discussed it with John? I asked. Not specifically, he said. Have you discussed it with Celia? No. But are you ready? He said. My career was going to take a hit. There was no avoiding it. I'd go from being a woman to being a mother, and somehow those things appeared mutually exclusive in Hollywood. My body would change. I'd have months where I couldn't work. It made absolutely no sense to say, yes. Yes, I said, I am. Harry nodded. Me too. Okay, I said, considering the next steps. So we'll talk to John and Celia. Yeah, Harry said, I suppose we will. And if everyone is on board, I asked, stopping before we got out to the sidewalk. We'll get started, Harry said, stopping with me. I know the most obvious solution is adoption, I said, but you think we should have a biological child? I do, I said. I don't want anyone trying to claim we adopted because we had something to hide. Harry nodded. I get it, he said. I want a biological child, too. Someone half you, half me. I'm with you on this. I raised my eyebrow. You do realize how babies are made? I asked him. He smiled and then leaned in and whispered, There is a very small part of me that has wanted to bed you since I met you, Evelyn Hugo. I laughed and hit him on the arm. No, there is not. A small part, Harry said, defending himself. It goes against all my greater instincts, but it is there, nonetheless. I smiled. Well, I said, we will keep that part to ourselves. Harry laughed and put out his hand. I shook it. Once again, Evelyn, you've got yourself a deal. Would the baby be raised by the both of you? Celia asked. We were lying in bed, naked. My back was lined with sweat, my hairline damp. I rolled over onto my stomach and put my hand on Celia's chest. The movie she was doing next was making her a brunette. I found myself transfixed by the golden red of her hair, desperate to know that they would dye it back properly, that she would return to me looking exactly like herself. Yes, I said, of course, it would be ours. We'd raise it together. And where would I fit into all of this? Where would John?
Wherever you want to.
I don't know what that means.
It means that we would figure it out as we go.
Celia considered my words and stared at the ceiling.
This is something you want? Celia asked finally.
Yes, I told her. Very badly.
Is it a problem for you that I have never wanted that? She asked.
That you don't want children?
Yes.
No, I suppose not.
Is it a problem for you that I cannot give you that?
Her voice was starting to crack, and her lips were starting to quiver. When Celia was on screen and needed to cry, she would squint her eyes and cover her face, but they were fake tears, generated out of nothing, for nothing. When she really cried, her face remained painfully still, except for the corners of her lips and the water brimming in her eyes that stuck to her lashes.
"Honey," I said, pulling her toward me, "of course not. I want to give you everything you've ever wanted, and you want that, and I can't give it to you."
"Celia, no," I said. "It's not like that at all."
"It's not?"
"You have given me more than I ever thought I could have in one life."
"You're sure?"
"I'm positive."
She smiled. "You love me?" she said.
Oh, my God, what an understatement, I told her.
"You love me so much you can't see straight?"
"I love you so much that when I sometimes get a look at all the crazy fan mail you get, I think, well, sure, that makes sense. I want to collect her eyelashes, too."
Celia laughed and ran her hand across my upper arm as she stared at the ceiling.
"I want you to be happy," she said, when she finally looked at me.
"You should know that Harry and I will have to..."
"There's no other way?" she asked. "I thought women were getting pregnant by men just using their sperm now."
I nodded. "I think there are other ways," I said, "but I'm not confident in the security of the situation. Or rather, I don't know how to ensure that no one finds out that's how we did it."
"You're saying you're going to have to make love to Harry," Celia said.
"You are the person I'm in love with. You are the person I make love to. Harry and I are merely making a baby."
Celia looked at me, reading my face.
"You're sure about that?"
"Absolutely positive." She looked back up at the ceiling. She didn't talk for a while. I watched her eyes as they moved back and forth. I watched her breathing as it slowed. And then she turned to face me.
"If it's what you want, if you want a baby, then have a baby.
We will figure it out. I will make it work. I can be an aunt, Aunt Celia, and I'll find a way to be okay with it all."
"And I'll help you," I said.
She laughed. "How do you suppose you'll do that?"
"I can think of one way to make it all a bit more palatable for you," I said, kissing her neck. She liked to be kissed right below and just behind her ear, where her earlobe hit her neck.
"Oh, you are too much," she said, but she didn't say anything else. She did not stop me as I moved my hand across her breasts, down her stomach between her legs. She moaned and pulled me closer to her, and she ran her own hand down my body. She touched me while I touched her, soft at first and then harder, faster.
"I love you," she said, breathless.
"I love you," I said back to her. She looked into my eyes and made me feel rapture. And that night, in giving of herself, she gave me a baby.
Photo moment. May 23, 1975. Evelyn Hugo and Harry Cameron have a baby girl. Evelyn Hugo is finally a mother, At the age of 37, the stunning bombshell is adding parent to her resume. Connor Margot Cameron, 6 pounds, 9 ounces, was born late last Tuesday at Mount Sinai Hospital. Dad Harry Cameron is said to be over the moon about the little bambina. With a string of hits behind them, Evelyn and Harry are sure to consider the littlest Cameron their most exciting co-production yet.
I was in love with Connor from the moment she looked at me. With her full head of hair and her round blue eyes, I thought for a moment she looked just like Celia. Connor was always hungry and hated being alone. She wanted nothing more than to lie on me, quietly sleeping. She absolutely adored Harry. During those first few months, Celia shot two movies back to back, both out of town. One of them, The Buyer, was a movie I knew she was passionate about, but the second, a mob movie, was exactly the sort of work she hated. On top of the violence and darkness, it shot for 8 weeks, 4 in Los Angeles and 4 in Sicily. When the offer came in, I was expecting her to turn it down. Instead, she took the part and John decided to go with her. During the time they were gone, Harry and I lived almost exactly like a traditional married couple. Harry made me bacon and eggs for breakfast and ran my baths. I fed the baby and changed her nearly hourly. We had help, of course. Louisa was taking care of the house. She was changing the sheets, doing the laundry, cleaning up after all of us. On her days off, it was Harry who stepped in. It was Harry who told me I looked beautiful, even though we both knew I'd seen better days. It was Harry who read script after script, looking for the perfect project for me to take on once Connor was old enough. It was Harry who slept next to me every night, who held my hand as we fell asleep, who held me when I was convinced I was a terrible mother after I scratched Connor's cheek giving her a bath. Harry and I had always been close, had long been family, but during that time, I truly felt like a wife. I felt like I had a husband, and I grew to love him even more. Connor and that time with her bonded Harry and me in ways I could never imagine. He was there to celebrate the good and support me during the bad. It was around that time that I started to believe that friendships could be written in the stars. If there are all different types of soulmates, I told Harry one afternoon when the two of us were sitting out on the patio with Connor, then you are one of mine. Harry was wearing a pair of shorts and no shirt. Connor was lying on his chest. He hadn't shaved that morning and his stubble was coming in. It had just the slightest gray patch under his chin. Looking at him with her, I realized how much they looked alike. Same long lashes, same pert lips. Harry held Connor to his chest with one hand and grabbed my free hand with the other. I am absolutely positive that I need you more than I've ever needed another living soul, he said. The only exception being Connor, I said. We both smiled. For the rest of our lives, we would say that. The only exception to absolutely everything was Connor. When Celia and John came home, things went back to normal. Celia lived with me, Harry lived with John. Connor stayed at my place with the assumption that Harry would come by days and nights to be with us, to care for us. But that first morning, just around the time Harry was due for breakfast, Celia put on her robe and headed to the kitchen. She started making oatmeal. I had just come down, still in my pajamas. I was sitting at the island, nursing Connor when Harry walked in. Oh, he said, looking at Celia, noticing the pan. Louisa was washing dishes in the sink. I was coming in to make bacon and eggs. I've got it, Celia said. A nice warm bowl of oatmeal for everybody. There's enough for you too if you're hungry. Harry looked at me, unsure what to do. I looked at him, equally uncertain. Celia just kept stirring, and then she grabbed three bowls and set them down. she put the pot in the sink for Louisa to wash. It occurred to me then how odd this system was. Harry and I paid Louisa's salary, but Harry didn't even live here. Celia and John paid the mortgage on the home Harry lived in. Harry sat down and grabbed the spoon in front of him. He and I dug into our oatmeal at the same time. When Celia's back was to us, we looked at each other and grimaced. Harry mouthed something to me, and even though I could barely read his lips, I knew what he was saying because it was exactly what I was thinking. So bland. Celia turned back to us and offered us some raisins. We both took her up on it, and then the three of us sat in the kitchen, eating our oatmeal quietly, all aware that Celia had staked her claim. I was hers. She would make my breakfast. Harry was a visitor. Connor started crying, so Harry took her and changed her. Louisa went downstairs to grab the laundry, and when we were alone, Celia said, "Max Girard is doing a movie called 3 A.M. for Paramount. It's supposed to be a real art house piece, and I think you should do it." I had kept in touch with Max, on and off, since he directed me in Bout en Train. I never forgot that it was with him that I was able to catapult my name to the top again, but I knew Celia couldn't stand him. He was too overt in his interest in me, too salacious about it. Celia used to jokingly call him Pepe Le Pew. "You think I should do a movie with Max?" Celia nodded. "They offered it to me, but it makes more sense for you. Regardless of the fact that I think he's a Neanderthal, I can recognize that the man makes good movies, and this role is exactly your thing." "What do you mean?" Celia got up and took my bowl with hers. She rinsed them both in the sink and then turned back to me, leaning against it. "It's a sexy part. They need a real bombshell." I shook my head. "I'm someone's mother now. The whole world knows it." Celia shook her head. "That's exactly why you have to do it."
"Why?"
"Because you're a sexual woman, Evelyn. You're sensual, and you're beautiful, and you're desirable. Don't let them take that away from you. Don't let them desexualize you. Don't let your career be on their terms. What do you want to do? You want to play a mom in every role you take from now on? You want to play only nuns and teachers?"
"No," I said, "of course not. I want to play everything."
"So play everything," she said. "Be bold. Do what no one expects you to do."
"People will say it's unbecoming."
"The Evelyn I love doesn't care about that." I closed my eyes and listened to her, nodding. She wanted me to do it for me. I really believe that. She knew I wouldn't be happy being limited, being relegated. She knew I wanted to continue to make people talk, to tantalize, to surprise. But the part she wasn't mentioning, the part I'm not even sure she truly understood, was that she also wanted me to do it because she didn't want me to change. She wanted to be with a bombshell. It's always been fascinating to me how things can be simultaneously true and false, how people can be good and bad all in one, how someone can love you in a way that is beautifully selfless while serving themselves ruthlessly. It is why I loved Celia. She was a very complicated woman who always kept me guessing. And here, she had surprised me one more time. She had said, "Go have a baby," but she had meant to add, "Just don't act like a mother." Fortunately and unfortunately for her, I had absolutely no intention of being told what to do or of being manipulated into a single thing. So I read the script, and I took a few days and thought about it. I asked Harry what he thought. And then I woke up one morning and thought, I want the part. I want it because I want to show I'm still my own woman. I called Max Girard and I told him I was interested if he was interested. And he was.
"But I'm surprised you want to do this," Max said. "You are 100% sure."
"Is there nudity?" I asked. I'm okay with the idea. Really, I look fantastic, Max. It's not a problem. I did not look fantastic, nor did I feel fantastic. It was a problem, but it was a solvable problem. And solvable problems aren't really problems.